Mitzvah Shin Pei Zayin 387. Shelo Lasur Achar Machasheves Halev Urias Hainayim. That we should not go following our thoughts and our sights. Shelo Nosur Achar Machasheves Halev Urias Hainayim Shenemar Velo Sazuru Acharei Levavchem Yacharei Nechem Asher Atem Zunim Acharei. And we say in Kriyashma, that you shall not stray after your hearts and after your eyes, that you go lustfully after them.
Wait, I was going to ask about that in his statement of the mitzvah, in Halev.
Yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily mean something you're passionate about, it just means it's a thought.
That's the way...
In the sense that of your mind.
Right, mind. Yes. Instead of the word mind, they used to, those times use the word heart.
So it's not particularly about passion.
Vayomer Haman bilibo, that it says in the Megillah, that Haman said in his heart. That means that Haman thought. Haman said in his mind. Obviously, right. Hearts don't speak. Hearts don't even really think. But
I thought that the intestine is supposed to be the seat of some...
A kleios yoetzos, that okay. Colloquially, it's the... It's all these... the brain is such a... non-romantic organ that we have these. We want their innards to be the seat of thought. Inyan lav zeh shenim nanu shelo niyachen mach shevoseinu lachsho b'deyo shem hefech hadas Torah benuya olav. That you are not supposed to focus our thoughts to think about something that's against the Torah. Lefi she'efshar lavo mitoch kach leminus. That it's possible that you'll come to heresy if you do such things. Ela im yale alibo ruach lachsho beosan deos haraim yikatzer machashavto bohem vishana lachsho bedarchei haTorah hamitiim vehatovim. That obviously sometimes thoughts pop into your mind you don't necessarily choose to be having sometimes. So if a thought pops into your mind that's against what the Torah teaches, so then, as much as possible, you should try to limit your focus on this thought and to try to start thinking about things that are more Torahic. Yeah.
I assume the danger here is not minus, that you'd all of a sudden start, you know, believing in, I don't know, like, you know, in heresy, but that you know, that you would be tempted to do something that's usher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like, you know, it's...
there'd be Znus or Gneva or whatever, something like that.
Yeah.
That's not exactly how it's formulated, because if you start, you know, doubting the basic tenets of the faith, then the whole system is going to collapse. Then you could do Znus and Gneva mm-hmm. and the whole package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it doesn't work like this. You just start slowly. It starts as a small thing. You're not supposed to allow it entry.
That's the point. You're supposed to, when you find yourself dwelling too much on things that go against the Torah, then it's your obligation to fill your head instead with thoughts that are in consonance with the Torah as opposed to against the Torah.
Usually you try to convince himself or yourself that what's wrong is right. That's how it works. It doesn't work that the person chooses to do the wrong thing. The thoughts are try to justify something unjustifiable and do it. Afterwards, it becomes a habit, so to speak.
He's going to talk about that.
But the attraction, of course, of Venus, okay, is that that's a way that you can manage to fulfill your desires for, you know, Zeus and money and all the other things which are the Torah is controlling, you know. I mean, so the first thing that happened, for example, I think it's on Mamre Chazal there that Bnei Yisrael, they really believed in Avodah Zarah. They really thought that this lump of stone was God.
Yeah.
But they liked all the other stuff. They liked the orgies and the feasts and the, you know, whatever. They went along with it.
No, that's what I think. It's also some Chassidish Areva, who is it? One of these Chassidish people says that no one goes off the derech because for intellectual reasons. Mm-hmm. They go off the derech because they're tempted by something and that cannot be fulfilled under a Torah framework, yeah?
I respect that point of view, but I think it's not 100% correct. I think there are people who are very troubled by certain ideas or whatever, and they do go off for intellectual reasons.
Obviously people are complex, so you can't necessarily point to one thing.
Yeah.
But overall, when people are happy and emotionally satisfied, they don't change their lifestyles. That in almost every story of someone going off the derech, there is a very prime emotional component. You have this new literature that's popular nowadays, the off-the-derech literature, that people write memoirs of their... So, and again, what I've seen from those books, so everyone who has this experience and is writing these books had some very serious emotional problem, that emotional need that was not being met that led them to go off the derech.
And sometimes they were legitimate needs because they were being abused.
Fine, we're not
I'm just, I don't disagree with that idea in general, but I think they're at the, you know, the tail ends of the bell curve. There are definitely people who have real, I mean, not...
Okay, but I've never seen any story where somebody said, I had a beautiful life, I was totally happy, all my needs were being met, there was no problem, but then I went to the library and I discovered a book that argued against the Jewish faith, so therefore I decided, this wasn't for me and I have to be intellectually honest with what I superficially believe, and I leave the Frum community and I'm now living in Hawaii in a hippie commune. Yeah.
But what about the opposite, when people decide to change their lives in order to convert to Judaism? You could argue the same thing.
In reverse.
In reverse.
Yeah, often when people... Right. There, again, there's certainly an intellectual component, but, you know, a lot of times what draws people to Judaism is the community, everyone helps each other, the beautiful spiritual side of it. They find themselves being a very spiritual people. Yeah, you're right. It does work in reverse as well. Yeah.
Most people aren't pure intellectual souls, or... Somebody said, right. There's never a girl who was ruined by a book, you know.
The thing is, when people who have had, you know, reasonably normal, you know, from lives up to whatever, and they start really thinking about, say, the Holocaust, things that are just really unanswerable, and they just can't deal with it. I don't think that's like eating a cheeseburger. They say, I can't deal with it anymore. How could God allow this to happen? And all your arguments are not convincing them. And even though they have a pretty nice life in the Frum community, they can't.
You think people? I don't know. I
lived through the Holocaust. Yes,
I've never heard of somebody who grew up totally Frum and happy, and then hearing about the Holocaust, and then really starting to think about it, and then going off the derech.
Yeah.
I've never heard of such a thing, but maybe you know such people. And also, just on that particular point, that people. The Holocaust is definitely, obviously, one of the worst, but it is not the worst thing that ever happened to the Jewish people.
The destruction
of the Second Beis HaMikdash. The destruction of the Second Beis HaMikdash, first of all, there at that time, it was a greater spiritual... that changed the whole spiritual makeup and activities and stature of the Jewish people, as well as, if I'm not mistaken, you can double-check with historians, but I believe... that during the revolts that surrounded the destruction of the Second Beis HaMikdash, a higher percentage of the Jewish people was killed or sold into slavery than was killed in the Holocaust.
At least a third, anyway. It's very hard to estimate.
Right.
Yeah, probably, you know, I mean, but I think the Romans claimed that a million were killed or something. Mm-hmm.
Obviously not in terms of absolute numbers, but in terms of, but percentage-wise, proportionally. So that's why it really, really is incorrect to think that the Holocaust was the worst thing that ever happened to the Jewish people, and to think that, you know, if we didn't lose faith, that we managed to survive another 2,000 years after the second destruction of the Second Beis HaMikdash. So we don't need to lose faith after the Holocaust either.
Well, there are also personal things, obviously, that catastrophes happen to an individual.
Sure.
Yeah, there are many. There have been several, like even Khmelnytsky pogroms in Poland were terrible. It's like people who passed through that. It changed Jewish life completely in Eastern Europe.
If something happens to your own family and your whole village and like that, then whatever millions may have happened outside of that, that's not something which or makes any difference really.
But Holocaust is unique in a sense that. Nazis really wanted to eradicate all of the Jews. It's kind of like very similar to Purim and Haman, more than to whatever Romans did, because Romans just expelled Jews from Eretz Israel.
Right, they would have been happy if all the Jews just decided to become good Roman citizens and not practice their little, you know, tribal ways anymore. So, yeah, you're right. Okay, but still, Lemaisa, that's what happened, that the Romans killed a very, very large number of Jews. But, yeah, fact is that people go through really, really horrible things, and they keep the faith, and that's what characterizes the Jewish people, that we have a lot of adversity, and we don't give up. We don't give up. You just imagine how the people who you know, who survived the Holocaust and built the new lives in new places in Israel and America. You know, even my grandfather, my father's father, was married before the war with four children. And his wife and his four children all died. Mm-hmm. He moved to America, and he got remarried, obviously. He got married in Europe, but he moved to America, and he was a fine, upstanding Jew in America. So it's amazing just to think of undergoing that and then managing to go on with your life in a basically normal way, in a from Jewish way is really an amazing. We have it, chas v'shalom, any of these, anything remotely close to that should ever happen to any of us, but you know, we're very comfortable. And in America, nothing really bad happens to us. We're okay. We're, we have a comfortable, happy lives. And this is how we think. You just imagine something really catastrophic happening to you, just being able to go somewhere else and at a relatively advanced stage and restart your life and be a productive member of society and of the Jewish people is completely daunting, and yet people did it and they managed. Okay. Fine. Uchmochein shelo yirdo fa'adam achar mare einav. That not only should you, as much as possible, direct your thoughts towards Torah principles, but you're supposed to make sure that you only see things that are in consonance with Torah principles as well, and you should not run after things that you see. Uvichlal ze shelo lirdof achar tavos ha'olam hazek, yacharisam roch dai bizayon vakotzev. That you shouldn't be too into earthly pleasures. You have to remember, again, I know the famous story of Rav Hirsch going to, why did he go to Switzerland in order to see the Alps? Okay, that Kosh Baruch was going to say to him when he goes to Shemayim, no, did you see my Alps? So we have to be appreciative and enjoy the things that the world has to offer, but we can't be rodef. We can't pursue more and more earthly pleasures. Uzesh amru zichrono levracha velo sasura acharei levavchem. When the Torah says, you shall not run after your hearts, you should not stray after your hearts. Zo minus, that's heresy. Da'acharei einechem, and when it says look to stray after your eyes, zo znus. This is improper sexual things that you're not supposed to run after these things. Shenemar ba'yomer Shimshon el aviv osa kachli ki hi yashra be'enai. There's a story about Shimshon, one of the shoftim, that he wanted to marry a Philistine woman. So he looked at her and he thought that she was extremely beautiful, and he said, "No, I have to be with her." So you have to, when you go just based on what your eyes see, as opposed to analyzing it intellectually, then you get into problems. Shorash mitzvah zo nigla. The reasoning behind this mitzvah is obvious. Ki vazeh yishmor ha'adam yishomer adam mechato l'Hashem kol yama. That if you adhere to these principles, you are not going to sin. This is the very major foundation of religion. That improper thoughts are the progenitor of all that is impure. And the deeds are like the progeny of the thoughts, which are the parents.
I mean, this seems to be such a basic idea.
Yeah.
That almost, why do you count it as a mitzvah? I mean, you know, certainly there must be general exhortations, you know, do good, not evil, all over the Torah. If you don't say, oh, there's a mitzvah, and this will number so-and-so, you know.
Right, but the idea is that, okay, it's a specific exhortation not to focus on these things. Again, yes, do good, not evil, but here the point is that it's specifically rooting out even the source for these things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, do you need this mitzvah? Yeah, you would say, right, if you if you says don't eat a cheeseburger, and you start thinking about cheeseburgers all day long, so you're gonna get into problems. But telling you to nip it, and then it's going to be just harder for you to control yourself about eating the cheeseburger. So you have a specific mitzvah to tell you, don't even think about it. You might think it's fine. You know, say, oh no, I'm never going to eat a cheeseburger. Never going to eat a cheeseburger. But, you know, it really appeals to me, so I'm going to start thinking about cheeseburgers all the time. I'm going to have a picture of a cheeseburger in my office, and I'm going to hang it in front of my desk, and every once in a while, I'm going to gaze up longingly at a cheeseburger. So no, so that's telling you that it's not allowed, because you're not supposed to dwell on things that are prohibited. Bim yamus adam terem yolid ein zecher labanim. And if a person dies before having children, then there's not going to be any children that come out of his self. Nimtzei zos hamaniyah shoresh shekol atovos yotzos mimena. So that if God tells us that we shouldn't start dwelling on doing sins, so there's never going to be a question of any existence of things that result from the thoughts. The same way that if you don't have children, so there's not going to be any continuation of your physical genes. V'da b'ni usay margila b'fumach mash'amru zichronam l'vracha, that it should, you, my son, again, he's addressing the same v'chinuch to his son, that you should always think about what our sages tell us in Pirkei Avos, avera goreres avera u'mitzvah goreres mitzvah, that if you start with one sin, it's going to lead to another, and if you start keep on building up mitzvos, they're going to, one is going to lead to another. Shim toshis datoch l'malus ta'avoscha hara pam achas timoshech achara kam epamim, that if you decide to indulge a sinful desire once, so then you're going to think, okay, one more time, you're going to keep doing it again and again. And that's also, he doesn't quote this line exactly, but there is a line in Chazal, in the Gemara, which says that once a person does a sin and repeats it, it becomes heter, becomes permissible. So then the Gemara says, what? It becomes permissible? What are you talking about? So everyone should do sin. Everyone says you should do sins twice, so then the ones afterwards, it's permissible, so what's the problem? So the Gemara answers, of course, that's ridiculous, it's not what it means. It means that once a person does a sin twice, it becomes in your mind like it's permissible, and you don't even think twice about indulging in the sin again. And if you control yourself the first time, it's telling you, if you give in a few times, then it's going to be much harder to do tshuva and prevent yourself from doing it in the future. But if you are very strong and you don't allow yourself to give in to the temptation even once, then it's going to become easier to continue to control yourself and not to engage in the sin the next several times that you're confronted with the temptation. So yeah, so people have different, talking about closing your eyes, so people have different ideas about what they should do. I know someone who, when he walks outside in the street, he removes his glasses.
There are famous stories about that.
Does he trip?
Well, I know someone in person. No, I guess his vision isn't so bad that he'll trip, but that he won't, if there are any sights outside in the advertisements or in the summer, perhaps people who are not necessarily in consonance with the way the Torah feels it should be, things should be presented, then he doesn't want to see it. He doesn't want to see it at all. So there's there's a balance between that. So you have certain people. This is more, I think, more common in Israel than in America. In America, this wouldn't fly if a man, you know, wouldn't look a woman in the eye, and wouldn't. So sometimes in Israel, you know, a man doesn't ever look a woman in the eye, and will talk to her, you know, with the eyes slightly averted. So that's in America, that would be considered a rude. But if it's normal in the Israeli society, so then okay. I mean, I don't know if it's ideal, but. There's what to be said for such a thing, especially if
the story about a rav in Poland, I forgot the name of the town, but is this for real, who took a son-in-law who was going to be learning. He was living in his attic. I mean, that's what happened those years. And one day this man went out, he wanted to buy something, and he was averting his eyes from everything because of what you just said. And he bumped into his wife, and he didn't recognize her. And the father-in-law made them divorce.
Okay, it seems a little extreme.
He couldn't recognize his wife, for heaven's sake. He bumped into her because he wasn't looking at women.
Okay.
Well, he bumped into a woman, and that's terrible. Imagine if what burnt his wife. That'd be much worse.
A lot of extremism on both sides.
Yeah, so in Israel, people tend to be more extreme. They are Rabbi, the shir about the wine that we had this last Wednesday night, so Rabbi Zekbach was talking about how in Israel things are more extreme. His father was a Rav in Strasbourg, very serious Rav. For many years, so he says that in Chutz Laaretz, you know, the rabbis will be lenient. They'll say, "Well, there are many considerations to be lenient." This is what we know. So in Israel, no. All these considerations we don't like. No, just go with the chumras. Yeah.
That's not such thing as Yain Mevushal, for example. That
right. Yain Mevushal is a chumra. Yain Mevushal is referring to the fact that some Israeli poskim. Rav Yoshev and Rishon Lezalman both held that pasteurized wine is not considered mevushal. Yeah. And every wine that's labeled, you buy in the store, is labeled yain mevushal. It's not really cooked over an open fire. It's just pasteurized. So therefore, they would hold that it's not considered mevushal, and a non-Jew is not allowed to handle such wine even.
No, they can handle it, but you're not allowed to drink it.
Right. It's usher for them to handle it, but they're not allowed to drink it.
You're not allowed to drink
it.
Oh, I did notice a quick aside here.
Yeah.
I actually noticed that the Herzog, I think Sonia Blanc, has the Hashkafa from Ada Haredes. Yes, it has on it, beside the OU, is the Ada Haredes of Yerushalayim.
The Baron Herzog?
Oh, yeah, right.
From California?
Yeah, I showed that to you. Yes.
The only wine that the Ada Haredes, I have ever heard of the Ada Haredes making in America, is they made a run of grape juice at the Kedem plant, which is they bottled under the label Geula that you find sometimes in the stores and really...
I'll send you a
picture. But send me a picture. That would be extremely interesting to know that that is the case. The Haredes, normally they don't make wine in Chutzar. They make grape juice because there's the grapes that are grown in Eretz Yisrael are usually tend to be of the higher quality, so they're used either to eat or to make wine. So sometimes to make grape juice, but a lot of the grape juice... they export from Chutz Laaretz. So I know the Ada Haredes has a production of grape juice in Spain that they make alongside Rabbi Zekbach. They borrow his mashgichim and they make their own production because the Ada Haredes has a policy that they do not accept any product unless it's under their hechsher. Again, that's not saying everybody else is trait, but they're strong enough and powerful enough, and they're trying to monopolize, I guess, enough that they will not allow any product that it's under an establishment or in that's even in a product that they make that's not under their hechsher. So Rabbi Zekbach was also telling me that he gives the hechsher to there's a wine yeast factory in Denmark. Mm-hmm. And he gives the hechsher, and almost every kosher winery in the world uses the wine yeast, so you're buying wine, so you're relying on his hechsher indirectly. So he says, once a year, the Ada Haredes comes, and they come to his factory, and they kasher it, even though it's completely kosher the whole year, and they make their own run of wine yeast for 2 weeks, and then they package it, and then all the wineries under their hechsher have to use this wine yeast, because this is the official Ada Haredes wine yeast. Again, he says, it's exactly the same as my wine yeast. Okay, but my father was flexible. He wasn't like, no, don't either trust me or not. He said, okay, this is what you want to do, and you want your own wine yeast, so you come into my factory, you kosher it, whatever you want, and you have your own wine yeast. But that's their policy, that they want absolute control over all the products under Hashgacha. They're not relying on anyone else, so they want all the products to have their official Hashgacha. And he says it doesn't cost him anything, it doesn't cost the factory anything, because the Ada just charges it through to their clients. The wineries that have the Ada's Hashgacha have to end up paying for this special production of the winery. So the same thing. So there's a grape juice in Spain, maybe in France also, that the Rabbi Zekbach gives the Hechsher to. He says the Ada Haredes does their own little production. They use his exact same mashgichim who are making his wine, but they have a representative from the Ada Haredes who's coming to watch and make sure everything is done to the Ada Haredes standards, which again, in general, they might have a certain chumras, but in general, it's not necessarily that they're different standards, but that they insist on being in control of all the facets of their kashrus, which is something to be said for that. Again, it's not for everyone, but I remember there was a falafel store in the Mea Shearim area. It was under the hechsher of the Ada Haredes. And all of a sudden, the owner of the falafel store wanted to start selling Coke. He said people like to drink Coke, but they like to drink Pepsi. and we want to start selling Coke. So they started bringing in Coke and selling for Zoros. So the Eda pulled the Hechsher, because Coke is not under Eda Charedes Hechsher. Coke is under
Landau.
Rabbi Landau, who again is also considered a one of the big three Israeli Hechsherim.
He's just Nifter, yes.
He was Nifter, yes. Rabbi Landau is the Rav of Bnei Brak. He was just Nifter, but his Hechsher was considered, again, one of the big three, along with Rabbi Reuben and the Eda Charedes, so the big three, super machmir and also very reliable Hechsherim in Israel. So they said, no, we don't take Coca-Cola, even though everybody agrees it's kosher. Nobody has any doubts about the actual kashrus, but we don't accept Coca-Cola. We only accept Pepsi, because Pepsi under our Hechsher. And Coke
during the year or Pesach?
I don't know what the story is now. I haven't been to Israel for Pesach in a while, but it used to be, when I was in yeshiva, so they only got Pepsi. They never got Coke, because Pepsi was Ada and Coke was Rabbi Landau. And but for Pesach, not that the yeshiva had meals on Pesach, but for a while after Pesach also, the Hechsher on the Pepsi was Chasam Sofer Bnei Brak. What's pshat? They switched the Hechsher to Chasam Sofer Bnei Brak, which is considered a second-tier Hechsher, not on the same level as the big three. So what's pshat? They changed their Hechsher to Chasam Sofer Bnei Brak for Pesach. The answer is because I believe they're modernizing this policy now, but in the olden days, the Eda Charedes refused to give a Hechsher to luxury products for Pesach.
Oh,
they
really?
Said, we don't believe in it.
Oh, wow.
We don't believe in it. On Pesach, you should buy raw products and make everything at home. Recently, I think it's modernizing. Last year, I even saw in America, they had ketchup. With Eda, Kosher Pesach Eda.
Ketchup's not a luxury item.
I think they're updating
policy.
Yeah,
because they think it's a luxury.
What?
I read about
you mean
it.
A weekday food, ketchup. That's different. The luxury. Oh, so I also saw.
I read about this in one of those Frummy Women's magazines.
I also saw this year, I saw, whatever, chocolate chips. Maybe they would have given that 10 years also because it's an essential baking supply. Whatever. We have there are very few products in Israel, even fewer in America with Eda. Kosher Le Pesach.
I'll send you with it. You know.
All right, so please do send me the label. But so they would only give a Hechsher, again, in the good old days, the Eda Charedes only gave a Hechsher for Pesach to basic staples like sugar, matzah, wine, maybe one brand of cookies or something. I don't know. Sugar. I mean, for people, that ingredients that people need to make food at home as opposed to prepared foods. They would not give a Hechsher to soda at all for Pesach because they thought it's unnecessary and you shouldn't have it on Pesach because it's too newfangled.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like giving Hechsher to cigarettes, the same as giving Hechsher to Coca-Cola. It's just as bad.
Right. Okay. Not again. It might be usher to drink Coca-Cola because of v'nishmarta meod l'nafshoseichem, that you have to preserve your health. But
not between Coca-Cola and orange juice in terms of the health.
But the okay. Yeah, beseder. So that's a different story. The question is how much are hechsherim required to make sure that the food that they give hechsher to adheres to certain hashkafic things or ancillary halachic things. We were discussing before about whether they're allowed to give hechsher to a meat restaurant that serves wine with live music. Okay, it's all these types of things.
Would that apply to, like, would they, oranges are okay, but OUP, orange juice in a box is not okay.
Okay, for what? What do you mean?
The people that don't want.
Do I think it's fine for Pesach? Yes.
Yeah. The people who don't want to give a Hechsher to luxury products.
Yeah.
Whatever.
They'd also worry about the scales, the scale insects on the outside.
That's all. No, there is Ada orange juice. Yeah.
Would they take it as far as? I'm showing my bias already when I say as far as processed orange juice versus oranges. Oh,
does they either give Hechsher on oranges for Pesach? Yes, they'll go to. What do you mean? That's in a store. What do you mean?
No.
That's a raw ingredient. They're giving Hechsher on the Orla and the Trumusamaisis, not giving Hechsher on Pesach at all.
What?
No, they have places in Israel that are under a hashgacha, and they have the oranges, and they squeeze it for you on the spot. No, but I'm pretty sure that nowadays the Eid already started giving extra to more. Again, I don't know exactly where they draw the line, but they are somewhat
modern. It's more money, more of them are more affluent. so it's going to be more.
That's true, but they don't lower their standards, but they just more in terms of the halacha.
Yeah. So, really, so you shouldn't let our eyes stray after orange juice again, right?
Right. Oh, just another thing before we continue, is that I believe also that the Ada has a policy that since machinery nowadays is so complex, they will not allow koshering any factory equipment when you're dealing with an Isser Deraisa. So another reason that very few products have Ada for Pesach is that means that all the machinery that's used to make this product cannot be used for chametz the entire year because they will not kosher it. For kidneys, yes, because that's not an Isser Deraisa. They will, if it was just used for kidneys, they will kosher it to use for Pesach. But if it was used for actual chametz, they will not allow the equipment.
So wait,
used.
So quickly, what would that include beyond the obvious?
Let's say ketchup for the year is used normally with made with corn syrup. So they'll kosher it and make it with sugar for Pesach. But if there was, but if the vinegar, let's say in the ketchup was derived from one of the five grains, then they would not allow koshering that equipment to use for a Pesach that could ketchup. So that's one thing. So you have all these when you turn look in Hechsherim. So sometimes not a pure halacha. Like if you were paskening the shayla, can I kosher this equipment? The answer would be yes. But the question is, sometimes people have a higher comfort level if they maintain certain made a halachic standards that are not actually necessarily required. But if they're more makbid on certain things, they just engender a greater sense of comfort. Again, certainly there are halachic issues as well with many things. Kiataiva, fine. Timshocha basar, kimshocha yayin el shosav. That if you give in to your temptations, then they'll draw you in, just like wine draws in the people who have a predilection for wine. Kiasovim lo sisva nafsham leolam v'yayin, aval yisav v'ylov taiva gedola. That people who are drunkards always desire more and more wine, and they're not going to be satisfied. Well, if he hirgilam nafsham bo techzak aleam tavosam, because they have become used to it, so therefore they are more inclined to indulge. Velu yishtu sham kos mayim yafu yikod oish taiva sayayin v'yerav lehem. That if they would just take a break and start drinking water and quit cold turkey, then they would perhaps be better. Yeah, that perhaps be better off. You have this problem. I don't know. People, like you say, so people nowadays, they somehow the marketing ploys have worked to the extent that people think that these sugary things are like standard beverages. I don't know. It's strange. The standard beverage is water. If you have something else as a treat or something occasionally, yeah. It's one thing. Yeah, it's a problem.
You should go to Atlanta headquarters of Coca-Cola. They own half Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
They bring in politicians there. It's like a, I don't know, like a palace.
Like, how did the advertising get off the ground? Why?
Oh, this is a fascinating documentary on YouTube. I
yeah.
Send you the link.
Okay.
You have an extra 50 minutes.
Okay.
Send me also.
But okay, I'd be happy to see it. But like, why on earth do people think that they should be drinking Coca-Cola all the time? Why? I don't understand that.
Growing up, we never even had soda on birthdays. We didn't have
I don't get it. Okay. There's one thing. We should start drinking water. Kena davar hazeh, or wine. A little bit of wine.
Oh, that's why, the arbicosos aren't part of the arbicachos, because these are poor questions, because, everybody saw their dad drinking, like, 4 cups of wine a night, no?
Yeah, the 4 cups of wine was not designed to be an imposition. If you think also that you have to remember that wine in the times of Chazal, even if it was 15% alcohol, whatever, that might be even higher than it was. It was a little syrupier, a little heavier than the wine we have today. Right. So the way it was consumed is that it was consumed with 1/4 wine and 3/4 water.
Wow.
It was diluted. So by the time you got to the end, you had a tiny cup. Remember, the Revius in those days was approximately half the size of this cup right here. And you have about this much wine and about this much water, and that's not so much. It's like 5% alcohol. It's not very much. And over the course of a long meal where you're consuming al korban pesach, along lots of meat, and you have lots of bread, and it's not at all designed to be in
bread.
Yeah, bread.
Matzah.
Not chametz thick of bread, but bread.
Oh, okay.
So right, so it's not going to be very intoxicating. So that's why people think if they have now we have chumras in a few areas. They have people have bigger cups because the chazan is shear for the rabbis, And then you have, if you fill it up with dry wine and you chug the whole thing and it's on an empty stomach, so then, yeah, so you might become a little intoxicated.
You're not even sipping.
Yeah, I
correct, yeah.
I have my own child, I will ask after.
Okay, sure. So it's just it's also a matter of taste that in the old, it depends what you get used to. So nowadays, our wines maybe are a better quality to drink undiluted. Mm. So that's why nowadays we drink undiluted wine. And if you prefer undiluted wines, you should drink undiluted wine for the 4 cups. But again, a person who slightly enjoys the taste of dry wine or doesn't want to fill a cup of sweet wine and wants to dilute it, so you could dilute it. So many poskim recommend that nowadays, since wine is very common and the taste of wine perhaps becomes diluted more quickly, so you should be machmir to have 51% wine. You shouldn't dilute the wine as much as in the times of Chazal, but up to that, so that's, again, you have to make sure the wine you're buying is 100% pure wine. They don't add water at the winery, which is done in certain inexpensive wines. So
how
it's really...
Tell?
You have to research. They publish lists of it.
Oh.
They don't have to say water added on the label, you know.
Right. So if you have a good quality dry wine, so then that's not going to have wine. It's not going to have water added.
What if you can't stand dry wine?
You can't stand dry wine?
Dry wine.
So you drink sweet wine.
Drink sweet wine.
The point of the 4 cups is that you should be an enjoyable experience. Uh-huh. They use grape juice even. According to, again, I'm not going to get into the whole discussion now, but even though Ramosha Feinstein was machmer that you shouldn't use grape juice for the 4 cups, Lemaisa, almost every other posting disagrees with that and feels that someone who prefers the taste of grape juice to wine is allowed to use the grape juice for the 4 cups.
Medical reasons why people
should. Right, so if they're real medical reasons, they'll make you seriously ill to use wine. So then either Moshe Feinstein would agree that you're allowed to use grape juice.
That situation.
Okay, but it's also a matter of taste. So if you just to get the idea of what it means to have diluted wine versus non-diluted wine. So for example, I drink grape juice. Fruit juice is extremely infrequently, maybe once every few years. But not, maybe that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but let's say I have a cold or something and I want to drink orange juice. So I find if I just pour a glass of orange juice, drink it, it's way too sweet and way too intense. So I'm gonna dilute the orange juice with water. So a lot of people do drink straight orange juice. So in the times of the Gemara, drinking straight wine without any added water was like, are you an alcoholic or something?
Well,
yeah, exactly. Not exactly. I mean, obviously, whiskey is much higher alcohol content than right. wine, but it'd be so, like drinking exactly like a whole cup of whiskey. Like, what are you doing? That's strange.
Four, yeah.
So nowadays, for me, it's the opposite. I like undiluted wine, but I like if I ever have the occasion to drink oranges, I can't stand it. If it's undiluted, so you mix it with water, and that's that you could. So that's just a way of relating to the idea that the fact that they always used to dilute the wine in the times of Chazal.
That's why we always pour some water into the wine when we make kiddush.
You do that?
Who does that?
That's Alpi Kabbalah. Yeah, that's Alpi Kabbalah. That some people before they make kiddush, they pour a couple drops of water into the wine.
Yeah, but every time a couple of drops and.
It's not going to become
with a bottle of wine.
No. Yeah, that's supposed to be reminiscent of the idea that in times of Chazal they used to dilute the wine, and it also has Kabbalistic significance that apparently wine represents Midas Hadin, that the strict divine justice, and water represents Midas Harachamim, the attribute of divine mercy. So if you're supposed to sweeten the divine justice with a little bit of mercy by pouring in water into the wine. I've only seen in my life maybe a couple people do that, yeah. Usually in our circles, again, if you do it, it's fine. But usually in our circles, we're not makpid on that, and we just pour the wine into the cup and then make kiddush. Kena davar hazeh, kol ish bergelo v'tavos v'asmido bohen yechazak olav yitzur hara yom yom. So the same thing, that if you indulge too much in your temptations, then it's just going to become more regular and more ingrained. You're going to be happier if you refrain. That God wants you to be straightforward, and you're trying to have all these calculations to do differently, and it's not going to help you at all. So the idea is pretty simple. Don't go off with these improper thoughts. And in our discussion of the reasoning of the mitzvah, we explain more or less what's going on. Benoiges mitzvah zo b'chol makom v'chol zman b'zchar min akevos. It applies in all places and all times, and males and females. Obviously, there's no reason for there to be any difference between males and females regarding this.
Is this amplified on in Sefer Halacha? You know, when they actually they're.
If you look at the Rambam's discussion of this mitzvah, it's a couple paragraphs long. Mm-hmm. It's not it doesn't even tell you really more information than the Sefer HaChinuch. And the reason is because it's amorphous. That the idea is you're not supposed to focus on it. Mm-hmm. So it depends what's called focusing. It depends. Yeah.
Don't say you know it's usher to have a TV because of you know this mitzvah.
maybe. Yeah, so they say there's a different pasuk that says you're not allowed to have a TV. Lo savi toeva beisecha. Because in the Torah, you're not allowed to bring an abomination into your house. That's why you're not allowed.
Nature specials, come on.
So if you have a TV that's locked and you only can only access the History Channel or National Geographic, so then maybe it's okay. But the problem is there's a lot of stuff on TV that would present a serious problem of, if not heresy, then znus.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, so you're not allowed to, you can't subscribe to pornographic magazines. You can't, that's part of this whole thing. That's called focusing on things that are against the Torah.
I assume you're not supposed to. In addition to not subscribing, you also shouldn't buy them one at a time.
Yes.
That's also true. At a time. They used to be under the counter. Now they're over the counter, right?
I don't know. Have you seen a picture in a magazine
that's seeing
a woman in a state of undress?
Is seeing a picture in the magazine the same? No, what do you mean?
No, because you seem to imply that seeing a woman in a state of undress on television or doing something that you're not supposed to see.
Well, there's a difference between if you turn on the TV and you flip to a show where something inappropriate is going on, then that's different from walking down the street and out of the corner of your eye you see
the subway.
You know, a woman jogging in gear that we would not consider appropriate for Orthodox Jews. Yeah. But in terms of pictures are very strong.
You can't even read the New York Times. Yeah, look at the underwear ads. I mean, really.
Don't read the New York Times.
No.
Yeah, well, that's another
issue.
But
right. I mean, the Sunday
magazine.
Yeah.
The Sunday magazine.
The ads, they're impossible.
Right.
And I'm not the class for me, believe me. But they're impossible.
Yes, but there's a difference, again, because you try to avert your eyes on the subway also, but there's a difference between that and
Seeking it,
exactly. Absolutely. 100%. But in terms of so you also have to figure out what's normal in terms of your point about the pictures. I think in the Jewish press they have a little column every week where Rav Schechter is asked one question. It's like a tiny little column.
Oh.
It's a tiny little column where they ask where the editor of the Jewish press asks him one question and he responds in one paragraph. It's a tiny little thing, but they're usually like interesting topics. Like the other week he had a discussion as like if you're allowed to kiss your great aunt. something like that.
How old are you?
I don't know if they're online.
How old
Rav Schechter, so it's a bit of a chiddush, but Rav Schechter said, Lemaisa, you are allowed. Because the Rambam sounds a little bit stronger about it, but the Rambam says that besides one's mother and presumably grandmother, I'm talking from a male perspective, obviously, that you're not supposed to hug and kiss people with whom you're not allowed to have relations, most women in the world, that even if you don't have any erotic feelings towards that person. So, for example, the Rambam even says that one is not allowed to hug one's sister over the age of bas mitzvah because. Said it's foolish. It says that she's usher to you, and it's not your mother, so you're not allowed to. You shouldn't hug your sister at such an age. So basically, Rav Schechter said that it's not. Again, he does. Again, the Rambam does seem to present it in stronger than this. But the way Rav Schechter is interpreting it, and others interpret it as well, is that it's not really usher. It's only foolish. So therefore, if your great aunt is not from. And she'll be offended if you don't kiss her, and you have absolutely—it's someone. Not that subjectively you have no desire for this person. You could, if you maybe again, it would not be permissible for a 16-year-old boy to hug and kiss a 16-year-old girl just because he said that he says he doesn't find her to be particularly pretty. Obviously, that wouldn't work. But somebody that it's reasonable that you objectively have absolutely no erotic feelings towards, like your sister or your great aunt. So then, since it's only foolish and not really usur, so says Rav Shechter, that if they don't appreciate the idea of this activity being foolish, then you're allowed to do it. Then that is, a lot of people rely on that. It's somewhat of a chiddush, but okay. It's pretty reasonable to do so.
Oh, so that's
how I go. So again, this Rav Shechter said about. So he was asked about: is it really correct what they do in Haredi publications that they don't allow any pictures of women? So he said no, it doesn't really make sense because people are. It's not like every woman goes around in a burqa. Men are used to seeing women. So he said, unless the woman is completely improperly dressed, he says he doesn't understand. I think this is pasha. This is not like the woman. Of course, if there are certain communities, he says, that if there would be a community, again, not that this would necessarily be ideal, but if there were a community where women would never go outside. So literally, a man never saw any woman on the street besides his wife. Then maybe you shouldn't publish pictures of women. That's going to be shocking. He said, a normal society, a man knows what a woman looks like. So if a woman is properly dressed, so there's no problem with publishing a modest picture. And again, if you're talking, it doesn't mean that they have to be dressed according to exact Orthodox Jewish standards. That there was this famous instance where there was the war room when they were taking out Osama bin Laden and the war room, like a situation room. And the Haredi publications published this famous picture of the war room, but they edited out Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State at the time. So they said it's not right to publish a picture of a woman. So Hillary Clinton, again, she doesn't necessarily dress exactly like an Orthodox Jewish woman.
She doesn't dress like a...
Exactly, but she doesn't go in public with a miniskirt and a tank top or something. So therefore, even that's really technically is not a problem to publish. And again, you have all these outcries. You know, it feels like you're erasing women from the world, which is a reasonable taina. Yeah.
Just one. I do subscribe to one mishpacha.
Yeah.
Okay. And whatever they think about it, it's partly the market why they use. But the thing is, I look at this. And you have young women reading this publication, first and all that. And I'm thinking, after a while, I think, why are they only seeing pictures of men? They write a glowing article about a Rebbetzin. Why shouldn't they be inspired by a picture of Nahum Leibowitz or a picture of the whichever Rebbetzin they're, you know? They should see pictures of women that they can emulate.
You're right. So it's interesting.
The girls should see them.
So it's interesting when yes and when no. So in certain of the art scroll biographies, they do publish pictures of women, and certain they don't. I really don't know what the rhyme or reason is. So actually, it's a chiddush to me a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the picture in the biography of Rebbetzin Kanievsky, so the whole book is filled with pictures of her. It's about her, so it's about her all the time. Okay. So that's but in some of the Hebrew ones, they don't publish any pictures of her in the biographies that are about her. But in the art school ones, yeah. But in other art school biographies, they do publish pictures. The one of Radelsky, I think they published a lot of pictures of his of women. And if you violate this and you start thinking about, you start focusing on things that distract you from the Torah into people who are the deniers and people want to shake things up. So that if you're running after just to enjoy the world without having any proper good intent from it in terms of what's going to come from it, intellectual analysis of what's good. So if you eat food, say this is delicious food, it's going to strengthen me to worship God, so that's okay. But if you're constantly, you know, every night you're going out to dinner at the fanciest restaurants, the fanciest restaurants, then that's no good. If you do this, so then you constantly are in violation of this commandment every time you do something that shows your focus on heretical or pleasurable things. You can't receive the penalty of Malkos of lashes because it's impossible to receive a hasra, a warning, before you, because not a specific activity, but rather a general mindset that leads to, so it can be the specific activities, but it's impossible to have hasra. Sometimes you're going to see out of the corner of your eye at least something that's not appropriate. So, okay, so it's hard to distinguish between that and focusing on it. It's only between you and God. So sometimes thoughts are going to enter your mind, but the idea is just what you focus on. It's impossible to set exact parameters for this mitzvah. You violate it without any action, just by thought. If it's possible to violate without doing a maisa, even if you happen to do a maisa, like you go into a restaurant and you order a very expensive meal for no reason, ain lokin olav lefi ha doma. Again, like an excessive manner, so you nevertheless would not receive the penalty of lashes because it is possible to violate merely by one's thoughts.
Is the conclusion from your sheer disrepute that you can kosher coffee makers as long as it's only had coffee?
Yeah.
As a generalization, not just related to Kura.
Yeah.
Oh, great. So let's. Okay.